All right, Dee, tee us up. Here we go. All right, today is a momentous moment. We're making the turn. We have finished, we could keep going on with church history, but we're making the turn into the New Testament. Now, and so we're going to do context today, and then we'll get to do the Christmas story next week, and then we'll break for the holidays. And then right after the first of the year, we will pick it up, and we'll kind of back up a little bit and lead into the Christmas story. But I wanted to go ahead and do the Christmas story next week, so don't miss that. And then next week, if you want to bring some extra cookies or something, it might be kind of a fun thing to kind of finish the semester. So a few years ago, I was serving on the High Council when the Plano State changed out state presidency from Mike Wilding over to Kevin Beach. And so I was on the High Council at that time, and I have enormous respect for President Wilding. And in that setting, he, as High Councilors, our last High Council meeting before they were released, he went around the room to each one of us and said, here's what I've learned from you, and here's what I've learned from you. Here's what I appreciate about you, and stuff like that. So he comes to me and he says, one of the things I appreciate about Brother Hinckley is that whenever we have talked about any scriptures, he's always got the context around it. He's able to tell us what is there about that, which always gave us a good start when we'd have scriptural discussions, which we would in High Council. So there she is.
Hey.
This is my son's in-laws.
Yep.
Visiting from Perth.
Yeah.
Okay, so what would happen here is then, so context to me has always been incredibly important. And certainly the Doctrine and Covenants we're talking about is the most highly contextual, meaning you really know you need to know what was going on with the saints at that time that spawned the Revelation. Well, as it turns out, the New Testament is also really highly contextual, but it takes more study to get behind it so that we understand what we're looking at. So I would start with this. What do we mean by that? Why is history a foreign country?
We need to avoid presentism, like applying our own culture and our own...
Which we really want to do. If I understand this here, then it should be the same back there.
Their thoughts are our thoughts, and they're not.
Yeah. They had their, but you need to understand why they thought how they thought.
Right.
Okay. What else?
Well, their daily life was different.
Day-to-day stuff, what they experienced. Yep.
If we were just taken and put back there,
oh, we'd be lost.
We probably would have trouble surviving.
Well, even if we're going back, so the British sort of speak English.
Yeah, maybe. Never been there.
But even if you went back to England, like in the 1800s, are you going to understand them? No. Because the language is different. The culture is different. The language is different. The circumstances are different. And so it's so dangerous to try and say they should think like we think and act like we act because we understand this, without understanding the level of knowledge and understanding that they have. Okay, so I hope you like history, because today you're getting a dose. Because I think it's going to be pretty hard to understand what's going on in the time of Jesus if you don't understand the historical background behind it, because we're going to refer to that quite a bit. So here we go. Okay. So in terms of getting ready for first century Jewish Israel, I'm going to go way back. I'm going to go back about, that we're going to look at the history, and then we're going to look at the theology of it, what they believe, and then the scriptures they were using to work from. Okay? All right, we're going to do all that in about an hour. All right, so let's begin. The best way, I think, to start... By the way, leading into the time of Jesus actually goes back, we've got to go back about 700 years. Because in about 715, Hezekiah it doesn't like all the idolatry that's going along in ancient Israel. And so he's actually going to go in and he's going to destroy Moses' staff with the serpents on it. He crushes it up a little bit and he scatters it in the Kidron Valley because they were starting to worship that pole. Okay? And he's also, because at that point, under Hezekiah, believe it or not, the Jews these days, when they pronounce the Shema, which is Shema Israel, Adonai Adonaihu, Adonai Echad, meaning our God is one God. Listen to him. One God. Right? Under Hezekiah, it wasn't one God. They, at the same time as Baal worshipers were out worshiping and they had fertility rites and stuff going on, ancient Israel was worshiping Jehovah, but they also worshiped his consort, Asherah. And he was the tree of life, and an observant Jew would go to the Asherah shrines and pour wine oblations and grain oblations, and they would bake her cakes and everything because they expected this female deity was also looking over and protecting them, and she was almost like, to use kind of Catholic terminology, she was almost like the patron saint of fertility and birthing and mothers and stuff like that. Okay, so they were worshiping her, and there were shrines all over Israel to Asherah. Now, again, Baal had its stuff, and Hezekiah starts the reform, and he starts to kind of cut down on all of those, and he's getting rid of the stuff out of the temple, because we think there was an Asherah tree of life in the temple complex. Okay? He dies. His son is Manasseh, is kind of wicked, but then comes King Josiah. And Josiah, and they're kind of trying to clean things up around the temple. They find a book of the law, which I think is back then would have been kind of probably Deuteronomy and Leviticus. Probably not much more than that. And he's young, but his courtiers around him are like, this is the law. We ought to get going here. Let's really impact some reforms. And what Josiah does in 623 is he actually changes dramatically the Israelite religion, more than we understand. Change it by quite a bit. For one thing, as he's doing that, he's going to get rid of all the shrines. He's going to threaten or kill anybody that is administering these shrines. He moves all of the worship to the temple. No more shrines. He's going to institute what we've been kind of laughingly talking about sometimes, sola scriptura, that it's all about the Bible. Under Josiah, it's all about the law. And no other writings, nothing else matters. Okay, and so it's really strict and it's heavy because we've got to get rid of the idols because the Assyrians are gathering strength out there. This is the way we're going to save our country, is that we've got to become really conservative religiously and focus on the temple. This is going to work. Okay? Does it work? Yeah. It doesn't. But that means that when in 586, when the Babylonians sweep through, and again, this is just as Lehi, just before they conquer, Lehi takes off. There's a lull in the battle. They're able to actually escape. So Lehi is now gone. Of course, they're going to take with them some brass plates, which would be some additional records. They'll take those with them. But the Babylonian conquest will then destroy the temple, destroy the people, haul everybody off to Babylon. And the religion that they're hauling off to Babylon is what King Josiah has formed. Okay? Does that make sense? Because if you think about it, the Israelites go into Babylon. Who comes back? The Jews. That's where the shift has turned. Okay, the 10 tribes were carried off, but there was still kind of trying to hold on to the Israelite religion. But Josiah has made changes, Now they're going to go off into Babylon. And the other thing that's going to happen here is that the other significant that happens in the 70 years that most of Israel is in Babylon, about half, I guess. This is when most biblical scholars will tell you the Old Testament was written. They've got traditions of what Moses did. They've got traditions of Adam and Eve. We don't know how many scrolls they've got. We don't know how many of those are myths. But this is when they actually go ahead and write the Tanakh, which is the Pentateuch, the Bibles of the Old Testament. And it's also because, think about, if we're going to take a people that has just been hauled off to Babylon, and you've lost your temple, you've lost your culture, you've lost your people, you've lost your society. While they're, and it says in the Old Testament, they talk about how they were on the banks, that they're refugees on the banks of the Tigris and Euphrates, looking up at this magnificent city of Babylon, and they weep for Zion. Well, the scribes that start writing, like, we need, if we're going to preserve Israel, we've got to write. We need a book. We need to collect all of the myths, all the scrolls, and start writing all of this stuff. And they're going to start to write it. But there's sometimes a thought that says, if you're going to try and if you're going to tell your story about what's happened for hundreds of years in Israel, you're going to inflate it a little bit. Okay, so it's not like, so what they're going to write, and we're going to get it in 1 Kings and Chronicles and Joshua and all that, it isn't like the Israelites just came into Canaan from Egypt. They came in and they did what? They conquered it. They, you know, they wiped out things. There was this magnificent battle at Jericho, and they're blowing the horns, and it was amazing, and the walls fell. Except that the history's off, because the city of Jericho had been abandoned for like 200 years. Oops. And we're trying to understand God, so we're going to take this great poem, this myth of Job, this Job guy, of which there's a story in Assyria, and all these other people have this story of this guy that gets tested by God, and we're going to give him our Jewish poem, our Jewish side of it. Let's throw that in there. And we got this King David who did a number of great things, but in when we're going to write the story so that these people huddled on the banks of the Euphrates have somebody they can listen to, or they can read and inspire them, we're going to make King David bigger than life. And King Saul bigger than life. I mean, they just got to... This is like, we're going to read stories of Robin Hood, something like that. So all I'm saying is it's hard because we know that most of the Old Testament, the Tanakh, is written in Babylon. It's hard to know when we look at the Old Testament how much of that is truth and how much of that is myth. We don't know. What we do know is that when we read the Old Testament, there are times that we just feel the spirit of Isaiah, and we feel the spirit of all that. And then times we're reading stuff about, you know, the other stories, and just like, it just doesn't feel right. There's something here we just don't know, but we're just going to learn, take a lesson from it.
Yeah. That just makes me so grateful that I can trust everything my computer tells me.
Yeah, absolutely, and social media.
My browser.
Yeah. So what's going to happen here is that we get Josiah reforming, then the Bible is written, or the Old Testament is written, and then Cyrus, 70 years later, is going to capture Babylon and send the Jews home. Yeah.
So this oral history is from Israel. What's Judah got? How did they...
Well, it really is Judah, because remember, the 10 tribes are off, And who really goes into Babylon is mainly Judah and Benjamin and some of the tribes that were down there, but the vast majority of them are gone. But they still, remember, they still had an Israelite viewpoint. Now it's been changed. So it's very focused when they come back.
So is that a reason that they quickly assimilated and were lost because they did not have a powerful enough history?
Who? Assimilated where?
The Israel. If this comes from primarily the Jews, what did Israel have when
The ten tribes?
Yeah,
if you're that's what makes it hard, because as the ten tribes are up there, and remember, just before Hezekiah, the Assyrians come down and they're taken into the north countries.
Yeah,
it's hard to know, because we don't have nearly as much of their stories, but what we've got is King David, you know, the Judean king, the kings. We've got the Jew side of the story. We've got some of what we know from what we know about Israel. We know through the eyes of the Jews looking at Israel.
Okay.
So they know that there was another temple complex in Dan up by the Golan Heights. We know very little about that temple in Dan. You can go up to Tel Dan. We're going there next year. But we're looking at it through their eyes. Remember, the history is always written by who? The winners. That's right.
And men.
Yes. And men. That's exactly right. Okay. So in 70, you know, about 70 years later, they start to come down. Although one of the things we need to appreciate again is in at the time of Jesus, there, and we've talked about this, there were about 1 million Jews in and around Israel. There's another 1 million still in Babylon. Babylon's a nice place. You know, this city is incredible. Okay? And there's another 1 million now at the time of Jesus that as this conquest is happening, another 1 million that just go, let's just get on boats and go. And so they are in Africa. They are all over the Mediterranean. It's only about a third of the living Jews on the earth were actually in Israel at the time of Jesus. Everybody else is in the diaspora. They're scattered. Okay?
Who actually compiled the Bible, at the Old Testament as we have it?
Hang on to that.
Was it Amos?
Ezra. So this is going to come out of here, then we're going to actually start to write it. So Ezra's going to start to put this together after they get back.
How does Babylon contrast with Babel?
It's on the footings of.
So, I mean, the Tower of Babel was centuries before.
Yeah,
millennia
back there.
So are they actually associate with each other, or do they just have a similar name?
No, they're in the same area, but you got to remember too that that's a different time, because these are Babylonians are a whole different ethnic group than the one that were scattered at Babel.
So it's most safe to just not consider Babylon and Babel to be the same.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so they get there, and now what's going to happen is they're going to start in 500 BC to start to rebuild the temple. Now remember, the Temple of Solomon was this magnificent edifice. They're coming back. They're pretty poor. Everything's been wiped out. Everything's been destroyed. They just don't have the money. They don't have the time. They don't have the understanding. They don't have the leadership. So they're going to start over time to slowly start building a temple under the direction of Zerubbabel, the priest at the time. And it's going to take them 500 years to slowly build this until we get to Herod. So the temple that sits there for about 500 years is not that great. It's just not. And which is hard for these people that have seen Babylon and seen the Hanging Gardens and all that stuff, that now we got this small little dusty thing on top of Mount Moriah. And we just don't have the ability to create much more of that. Okay? All right. So the temple starts to be rebuilt, but it's going to be, but it's based on, and what they do is based really on what's coming out of how they rewrote the scriptures, and everything is going to be simple, centered right at the temple. Okay? Yeah?
Just one thought here. If Lehi left just before this Babylonian conquest, then those brass plates become pretty important because they predate this Babylonian era.
See, and so that means that the brass plates weren't in Babylon while they were collecting whatever records they would have had, so they didn't have access to all of that. That would have helped. But they didn't have it, so I think that's a great point. Okay, so now, now they're sort of getting back to business, except for the fact that, a couple of hundred years later, here comes the Greeks, Alexander the Great, and he just sweeps in and he's conquering everything around him. Okay, now the Greeks are fun because they're cool. They are really cool. They are kind of suave. They've got this philosophy in the way of thinking and looking at that, and they've got this language. In other words, we're not going to take away your religion, but we're going to start to overlay this Greek coolness, you know, and so actually end up over time everybody stops speaking Arabic and they start speaking Greek. So over time, now everybody starts slowly speaking Greek, and things are nice until what happens here is that Alexander the Great dies, and his kingdom is split up into three main leaders. Okay, and that means that who's watching over all of this stuff? Well, they're going to fall under the Seleucids. Okay, well. Most important among them in 168 BC is Antiochus IV, bless his pointed head. Where the Greeks have always been pretty generous about letting you have your religion, Antiochus believes that the Jews are really not cool, basically. So it means what we're going to do is try and eradicate the Jewish religion, and we're going to try and eradicate Jews as much as we can. So one of the things we ought to do in this dusty little temple complex is that we're going to put in 168, we're going to put a big idol in the middle of the temple. It's a way of trying to say who's really in charge here. It's the Greek gods. It's not this Jehovah guy. Okay? Now, how well does that go over in 168? Okay? And that gives rise... Anybody know from your history, what are they going to do about Antiochus IV? It's time for rebellion. Who's going to lead it? The Maccabees. Yeah. And primarily, Judas the Hammer. You're going to Judas the Hammer, man. And Judas the Hammer, they're going to come from the north. And it's right about this time that the Greeks are dissolving, their power is waning. And Romans are starting to push in, and so they're weak enough that they can't defend, and so this little backwater place in Judea is able to actually rise up and defeat the Greeks. Okay? But remember, Greek is cool. Yeah. So we're going to defeat them, but we're still going to be speaking Greek. We still like that. Okay? So Antiochus is going to be destroyed. He builds a shrine, and then, so we get the Maccabean revolt, and they actually conquer about 4 years later. It doesn't take too long for them to actually conquer. So now if we're going to look around, who's now going to be in charge? We finally kick these Greeks out. Who's going to be in charge here? Well, the people that are, the ruling family that is left from Judean history is going to be a family called the Hasmoneans. And they're going to slowly consolidate their power. And so now from 141 basically to 37, we have an independent Jewish state, the Hasmoneans. Okay? Now, you need to know that the Hasmoneans, though, especially after all of that Greek liberalness, seductiveness, it's time for a crackdown. It's time to reframe all of this. And the Hasmoneans crack down. They are conservative. They are closer in the way that they look at things to King Josiah, because they're descended from him. Okay? And they're going to do their little crackdown. So here's what they do. So the Hasmoneans, very first, they're able to conquer the area right here around Jerusalem. So here's the Dead Sea, got the Sea of Galilee down here. So then what happens is, with each successive king of the Hasmoneans, they expand their territory farther out and farther out. So there's three things that they're going to do. One, they expand power. So they just keep conquering. They got their armies, they're working, and they're going to conquer not just, especially by the time we get just before the Romans come in, they've actually conquered this area down here, which is Jordan. Anybody know what Jordan down here? What's the main city down here in Jordan? It's not Amman. They're the spice trail that's going to run the spices from the south. It's called the King's Highway. The King's Highway comes up right up here, comes right up here, and it goes right up here to Babylon. Okay? And the Buckies at the time, if you will, on the freeway, the Buckies that's going to get incredibly rich is going to be Petra. This is the Nabataeans down here. They're gonna figure in here a couple of ways. Okay? The Nabataeans are very wealthy. Think about, if you've ever been to southern Utah, think about trying to set up a city right in Moab or in Canyonlands. You got sandstone. What are you going to do? Well, if we're going to build cities, where are we going to do it? It's easy to dig out the sandstone, put a cave in here, put a house in here, put a treasury building right in front of the sandstone. It's very cool. Okay? And in fact, we know from Hollywood that that's actually where they will hide. No, not the Dead Sea Scrolls yet. It's the Holy Grail. Yeah, remember? Harrison Ford is going to find the Holy Grail in there because the Nabataeans have grown very wealthy down here because of all of the caravans coming along the King's Highway up the Spice Trail.
Now, isn't the Red Sea in covering the whole area to the right?
Down here.
It's down south?
Down here, right down here. Oh. So they would come up this side of the Red Sea and then shoot up the back side of the Dead Sea and come up here past the Sea of Galilee.
Yeah, Petra's at the very north end of the Red Sea.
Yeah, it's right here. Okay. Okay. So number one, they're going to conquer territory. Number two, they're going to do something interesting, and it actually has some echoes to what Israel is doing today. A few years ago, when we were in Israel, if you go to the shepherd's fields in Bethlehem, and you look down over the shepherd's fields, there's a wide valley there where the shepherd's field exists, and then you look up the other side. Over there is the Jewish settlements that are looking down over shepherd's fields, and they're building apartment complexes, and they have their own water sources and stuff like that. It's kind of a source of irritation to the Palestinians living in Bethlehem, because these guys on the other side of this valley are living great, and we're not so much. When we were last there in Israel, though, now the villages are starting to show up right in the valley of Shepherd's Fields. They're building down there. Because what Israel is trying to do is anytime there is occupied land, they need places for people to live, so they're putting these settlements in what was Palestinian territory. And it's these settlements that are causing all of the angst in the UN and stuff like that, where Israel is building their settlements. Okay? Well, the Hasmoneans did the same thing. As they're expanding out, there's this big open space up here where the tribes of Israel used to live. And they're gone now. And it's open space. So nature abhors a vacuum. We don't want to leave this open space just sitting there. It's got to be filled with people. So who can we put up here? What we'll do, what they decided to do, was get devout people living in Judea down here, and we will convince them to leave the lands of their inheritance, and we're going to give them lands and places and cities up here. So we're going to establish little cities like Capernaum, Nazareth. Okay? All of these little cities up here, Migdol, all the, up there. Okay? So this is how, by the way, we're going to talk about this more next week. So the family of Joseph and the family of Mary, their ancestral home is down here in Bethlehem. What are they doing in Nazareth? Well, under the Hasmoneans, they were asked to move the devout people, and so they're now up here. That makes sense? So when Joseph has to go for the census, where has he got to go to get do his counting? Back down to the ancestral home. But that's why they were in Nazareth in the first place. Okay, that makes sense? Okay. So they're going to conquer land. They're going to conquer. They're going to fill the land in the north, and so this Hasmonean kingdom, it just continues to grow and expand. Okay. Questions on that?
So they become an outlying buffer for them.
That helps. Yeah. That's really a good way to put it too. Okay. All right. So one other thing the Hasmoneans do. Yes. Okay. Nabataeans. As we're expanding, if we're going to move into your area, we're not going to be like the Greeks and just let you stick with your own religion. So for the Nabataeans, like in Petra and stuff like that, we're going to do a forced conversion to Judah. So you got to become Jews. We're going to conquer your land, and you have to become a Jew. Okay? And in this forced conversion, guess who they end up converting among the Nabataeans as well? They convert and force convert the father of Herod the Great.
Does that include circumcision?
Yeah.
Okay.
Included.
Yeah, would that include circumcision?
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how many of these people are Abrahamic?
These are all Abraham.
So all of these people they're forced converting are from...
Yeah, I'm trying to remember who the... I don't know if anybody else knows who
Ishmael.
I think Ishmael. Because these are Arab, Nabataean Arabs down here, so probably Ishmael, okay? I would guess. But now they're going to convert the father of King Herod, who will become Herod the Great, okay? And that's how Herod, who actually is, he grows up as his father is Arab, and his mother is actually a Nabataean princess from Petra. Okay, and then he will live life as a Jew. Okay, all right, very cool. Which is fun. Sometimes when you're kind of out there, you can get to visit places like Beth Shan, where you get some of this old history. Love that place. All right, okay. So, now we're moving a little closer to the time of Jesus. We're kind of getting a little closer. So now we've got Herod the Great begins to loom really big on the thing. So in 63, this is interesting. So when some of the main leaders of the Hasmoneans dies off, now that it goes to the sons. And as anybody knows that has maybe owned a family business, and then the founder dies, and then it goes to the next generation? Yeah. Most family businesses don't last past about the second or third generation, because the genius that founded it is not going to be the genius that tries to run it down the road. Kids don't generally do as well, and they didn't hear. Okay? So now we get about 65, 68, these brothers that are both Hasmonean princes start a civil war. They're fighting against each other. Okay?
Brothers
fight a lot. And they're doing that. Now, an interesting thing that has happened, by this time, the Romans have slowly conquered, in a series of battles over time, they went out on the Greeks, and Pompey, General Pompey, is sitting up in Syria. And the Romans winning and taking over here is a little bit, guys, like if you lived in an apartment complex and the building got sold. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So now we have new ownership. They're not necessarily messing with you too much, but there's new ownership over the apartment complex.
And collecting different rent.
Yeah. Now, they're not interfering yet. But life is still going on, even though we have a new owner in town. And now we're really a vassal state of Rome. You just don't see it yet. Okay? So when these brothers start squabbling, we've got the civil war going, they both go up to Syria to make their case to Pompey. They know who's really in charge of the building, even though they're both kings. And the one brother is going to suck up, well, they're both going to try and suck up to Pompey, but the one is going to have like 6,000 pounds of silver, and he's going to bribe Pompey so that I get to be in charge. When the other brother finds out that's happening, where else can the other brother go to get come up with an army and wealth to fight against Pompey?
Doesn't have to fight against Pompey, though. He could just tell Pompey, hey, you can have my brother's silver and just put me in charge.
Yeah, which is sort of what he was doing, except the other brother goes to the Nabataeans and he goes to King Arius and he says, I need you to back me up here. And he bribes him. So one bribe goes to Pompey, one bribe goes to Arius, and Arius brings his armies, and they go in, and they actually defend the Temple Mount and the center part of Jerusalem. When the Roman legions, the 3rd and 4th legions, come down out of Syria, they come down there, and there's a siege at the Temple Mount, and the one group is under, is helping out with Pompey, and then the Nabataeans and the other group is, and it takes like months to finally bring in their siege engines, which the Romans were very good at, and they finally conquer in 63 BC. Pompey will then ride into the temple complex, and he will ride into the Holy of Holies.
With his horse.
Okay. Now, what they really wanted to know was, what's behind the curtain? It's just like, you know,
Wizard of Oz.
It's like the Wizard of Oz. Yeah. What's behind the curtain? Because there was all these rumors about what's behind the curtain in the Holy of Holies, because only the high priest gets in there once a year, Yom Kippur, right? So he was fascinated to find out what's behind the curtain. Gets off the horse, pushes past the temple of the altar of incense, opens the curtain. What does he find? Nada. There's nothing there. There's a stone there. And that's it. Now, the nice thing, though, for Pompey, though, is that he's fairly impressed with the rest of the temple, even though it's not that great at that moment. So he's going to do what the Romans do, basically, is we're going to come occupy Jerusalem, but we're not going to stop you from worshiping. So part of couple of things. So part of why they were able to conquer is that they found out that once a week they could actually make great gains in their siege. Why? Because the guys inside the temple complex would take the Sabbath day off. And at the moment, and this is true, Roman historians tell us that when they actually broke through the walls and they actually came into the temple complex, the priests were still administering sacrifices on the altars and doing their daily sacrifice. Hold on a minute, we got to finish this sacrifice. Okay? And then they're killed. So what will happen is that after Pompey looks behind the curtain, that they will actually clean out the temple complex of all the blood from all the priests, and then they will tell the remaining priests, go ahead and do the rest of your daily sacrifices. We're not going to interfere in here. But we're now, the Romans are now in town, and we're going to have a major presence from this time on till 70 AD, for 100 years. But to make sure you guys behave yourself, we're going to build this fortress just right overlooking the temple. It's called the Antonio Fortress, so that we can actually look down onto the proceedings about what's going on in the temple. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay. All right. Now, everything would be ducky at this point, except that, remember, that the landlord has his own battles, and he's got his own problems. And like it was with the Hasmoneans, the problem is not with the Romans from without. They're doing fine. They're conquering everybody. The problem with the Romans is always going to be from within. Okay? So Pompey's going to have his own problem with who? Anybody know your Roman history?
Caesar.
Okay? Now, just before that happens, well, it's actually in 40, they're going to appoint Herod, who has actually been one of these leaders there. They're going to make him the king of the Jews because he's now using his influence and he's starting to grow. But there's not that Roman presence yet, but it's going to expand in a really big way. But what's going to happen here now is that Pompey, who appointed him, talked the Senate into it, he's now going to have his own battle with Julius Caesar. Julius Caesar's going to cross the Rubicon. He's bringing his armies into Rome. Pompey has to flee. Now we get this battle back and forth between Pompey and Julius Caesar. He will defeat Pompey, and then Julius Caesar will be killed in the Senate on the Ides of March.
This is a supposed question. Do you think that the two brothers had not been fighting each other?
Yeah.
They had been united. Could they have kept the Romans out?
Yeah, at least for a long time, because they're not going to mess with them too much. If you're paying some tribute to us and you're not really making trouble, you'll be fine. But they invited Pompey in. Please come down and do this. Okay? And it's always the internal stuff. Okay? So Caesar gets killed. Pompey is killed. And now it's a battle for Rome. And now we're going to get this Roman civil war that happens between 41 and 31. And these names ought to be familiar to you guys. This is where I remember that Mark Antony, leading one faction of the army, he's going to be joined by Cleopatra. They're going to be fighting against Octavius, Julius Caesar's nephew, his adopted son. Okay, so we got this battle between Octavius and Mark Antony. So Herod's got to choose, who am I backing here? Who's going to win? Because I've got armies at my control. I can battle. Which horse am I going to do here? And what he does, he backs Mark Antony. Because Mark Antony had been at the east more. He backs Mark Antony. Oops.
Wrong choice.
Mark Antony is killed because Cleopatra also wouldn't support very much. She didn't do her part. So now Herod's got to go. So Herod's hanging out here. Here's what he does. Octavius goes down to the island of Rhodes, and this is where he's kind of resting and getting ready to go back to Rome. Herod will get on a boat and go out to Rhodes to talk to Octavius, who will eventually be known as what? He'll change his name to what? Caesar Augustus. Octavius is Caesar Augustus. Okay? Again, my name's ought to be familiar. But Herod's going to go suck up to him. And he actually makes a case. Yeah, I know I backed Mark Antony. I did. But I'm really loyal. And the people really like me. And so even though I was backing the other guy, I'm willing to support you, and I will be your most loyal servant. And he does this great sell job. And Augustus, Octavius, agrees with that. So he sends Herod back. And Herod will then go back and be... and what he's going to do now is Herod then goes back. There's been a little bit of a war down there. He actually, in 37, he has to fight another little battle. He wins it. He's reinstated by Octavius. So now he's going to consolidate his power. He will marry. That's what you do. You marry a Nabataean princess, or a Jewish princess, Hasmonean princess, Miriam. Now I really am Jewish, guys. Really. Really, really am. Okay? And he will start his reign. Yeah.
But he wasn't really following the Jewish faith, though, was he?
He was. He actually, and he became an observant Jew. But they never quite trusted him, because your dad was Arab, or your dad was Idumean, and your mother is Arab. But you're living all of this stuff. But we're still never going to really, you're not descendant from the kings of David.
I always kind of got the feeling that he really didn't believe fully in what the Jews...
He may not have, but he practiced it openly, and he wasn't a very good Jew.
Yeah,
let's just say that, okay? So he kills off the last Hasmonean king, and now it's time to suck up to Herod in a really big way, really big way. He's gonna be the main supporter behind the Olympic Games. He's gonna go out. Let me go back here real quick. Okay, there it is. Okay. Once he consolidates that power, he's gonna go to Caesarea Maritima, and he's gonna build this magnificent city there with amphitheaters, a deep water port. It's got, when you walk through Caesarea, it's got a horse track on there. Caesarea Maritima is a great place. Okay, here he's going to build another city. Anyway, where you're going to see a statue of Herod from the sea. You can actually see it from up here. He builds up Beit Shan. He's going to start putting his fortresses down at Masada. And he's going to build another fortress for himself in Jericho. And he's just going to be this main... He's just building Caesar stuff all over the place. So he's really kind of... Like I said, he's really sucking up big time. And so many things that you see in Israel are all Herodian. But now he needs to do one more thing, and that is the temple. Remember, the temple of Zerubbabel has been okay, but it's not that great. So what he's going to do here is that he's in 20 and 19 BC, he begins a major expansion of the Temple Mount that the temple sits on. So he's expanding it so that he can expand the size of the temple. He's going to expand the Solomon pillars on the south side. He just is going to really make this like an amazing place. Okay, the people are going to want to come from all over the world to come see this temple of Herod.
Is this the same King Herod that was alive when Jesus was born?
That's his son. Well, no, at his birth, yes.
Okay, because so he's the one that killed all the young men.
That's it.
Okay, and then his son
Herod
is the one that we most he. basically ruling during all of Jesus' lifetime.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. He's going to, I'll show you that in a sec. Okay? So he's going to expand the temple. And then in 4 BC is this when Herod dies. And this is when we actually think the date of the Savior is right about there. It's actually about 4 BC. Okay? Now, Herod Antipas gets Samaria and the Galilee. He gets the west. Okay? And his son Philip is going to get the east.
Is it his son Philip or his brother Philip?
His son.
Okay.
Herod's a great son. And so that's where we get like Caesarea Philippi. Block it. Caesarea Philippi. Okay. So he gets the Decapolis with all of
this. If he dies in 4 BC, then Christ was actually born like in 5 BC?
They think 4. They think right about that same time.
Okay.
Yeah, it makes sense. Okay. All right. So one of the things that you can actually see when you're going in there is if you're standing at the Wailing Wall, these are actually these massive stones are the footings underneath the Temple Mound. So if you're looking down here, you're primarily seeing from the Temple of Solomon because they're at the bottom. Okay. Then if you'll notice, then there's some smaller stones they think are maybe kind of added during the Hasmonean time. But it's these guys right here. I don't know if you can see that. They're big, and they're long, and they're wide. Those are Herodian stones. Herod is now building a large place underneath this, and these massive stones here are the ones that he adds. Now the rest of that, there's going to be Ottoman stones, and there's going to be Crusader stones, but this bottom down here is what Herod was actually trying to do. Okay? There's an arch of the Wilson Arch came right over the top of this thing, so from the west side of the city they could walk into temple. Okay. All right, how are we doing time wise? Okay, good. All right. So, is that enough history? That gets us right up at the time of Jesus comes. Now, here's the other thing that Jesus is going to run into. So, if that's history, here comes the religion. Now, as the Romans had like this really big presence now, the question is going to be, for if you're a Jew living in first century Jerusalem or in Israel, the question is, who's a Jew and who's not? Is there too Jewish or not Jewish enough? Okay, so the battle is always going to be there. So based on this question, who is Jewish and who is not, we're going to get this separation into four main groups. And because we have a tendency sometimes to talk about what did the Jews think? And how did the Jews treat Jesus? And what were the Jews thinking? What did they, well, depend on, it'd be like saying, what do Americans think of, France? Well, it depends on who you talk to, okay? So these groups we know, we won't spend too much time on them. The Sadducees are the ones that would really go back more to Josiah, and they believe that there is a written law, and that's basically it. So if you just live that, We are descendants from the kings. Under Hezekiah, the ruler was, the priest was Zadok. These are the Zadok seeds. Okay, so we have royal lineage. So these guys are the rich ones. They run the temple. They have big townhouses that are very Roman looking. Up on the city of David, up on the sides. The Sadducees were the ones that had the temple tax. When Jesus is talking about the temple tax, he's talking about something that the Sadducees are administering. They're the ones that make the money. and they charge too much interest, it's all going into the hands of the Sadducees. Right? They are the city dwellers, and they want to be as Roman as possible. In fact, I think I mentioned this before without being too embarrassing. A Roman gym, they would go in and they would exercise and they would do things naked, right? Well, if the Sadducees want to hang out with the Roman legions and those guys and Pilate and stuff, one of these guys is not going to quite look like the other guys. Some of these guys are circumcised and some are not. So we'll know who the Romans are and we'll know. So they were actually looking at ways to how do you kind of undo the circumcision so that you can look more Roman.
Or wear some underpants.
Yes. Got to do something. But we got to look as Roman as possible. And we're not even sure that that circumcision thing is not, maybe it's not necessary. Maybe we can do this and not, maybe, all right. Okay, so that's Sadducees. And then alongside, so if this is limousine liberals, here comes the moral majority. Here's the Pharisees, and they're in the country. They're not really organized, but the Pharisees are going to be living off of not just the Tanakh, those scrolls, but also every other little rule that comes along. We start to have in the Mishnah. And now we have two things we're living off of. Okay? You're supposed to live the word of wisdom. That includes caffeine. And chocolate. And too much meat. And we'll withhold your temple recommend if you are doing the caffeine like they were doing on my mission in England. You're drinking Coke? Yeah, well, you don't get temple recommend. Because according to the Mormon Mishnah, that's outside the... Okay? You're supposed to live the Sabbath. Are you watching football on Sunday? Are you wearing your church clothes on Sunday? They're just adding stuff. Okay?
Yeah, what about all these wicked people that watch the football game on Monday because they still play it on Sunday?
I know, and they're forcing these guys to work. We can debate endlessly in the synagogue whether that would be okay or not. Okay, but that's why you're supposed to not work on Sunday. Well, how far constitutes work? Then we start putting in miles. Well, that's what's, okay, the Sadducees aren't believing any of this stuff. But this is where the Pharisees are going, okay? Now, to try and keep the peace, though, what they're going to do is say, we need to have a ruling body over Judaism in general and the temple, so we're going to create a council that we're going to call...
Sanhedrin.
The Sanhedrin, which is going to be a combination of these two guys. So when we get to the trials of Jesus, you're going to find him pitting these guys against each other. Paul will do the same thing.
Is Mark a Pharisee? I mean a Sadducee?
Who? Mark?
Mark. Matthew Mark.
Oh. No, he's Gentile. Okay. Mark's Gentile. But he's spotting, he's telling the story about what happened. Now, there's another group, though. If you believe that this temple built by Herod has been corrupted by all of the stuff that's going on in there, and you don't think the Sadducees are going for the Romans, the Pharisees are not conservative enough, we're going to reject the temple altogether, and we're going to create a group called the Essenes. And the Essenes are going to live in little villages around there, and we're going to do the temple outside the temple. We're going to do ritual washings and cleansings and stuff like that, okay? Now, we're going to actually have a community center, where a retreat place, where you can actually go and copy scrolls and relearn what Essenes are supposed to be able to do. And we're going to do that in a place called Qumran, where we're copying Isaiah scrolls and we're copying all. And when in 70 AD, or 66 AD, when Jerusalem is burning and the Roman legions under Titus are pouring out of there, and they're on their way to the clean out the south. The Essenes at Qumran are going, yay! Finally, you know, this is where, because this is going to be the moment that the sons of light show up, defeat these Romans, and yay, this couldn't happen fast enough until the Roman legions kill them as well. But we hedged our bets by taking some of the things that we were writing and putting them in the caves outside of Qumran. And that'll be the Dead Sea Scrolls. Okay? So we got the Essenes. And then we've got... and then one other group just hates the Romans, will always hate the Romans, and this is going to be the Zealots.
The Dead Sea Scroll people tie in any place here?
Yeah, this is the Essenes.
That's the Zealots.
No, that's the Essenes.
That's the Essenes.
Yeah, when you go to Qumran, you can see all the mikvahs, all the baptismal font stuff, like the cleansing stuff that they did ritually, but then you also can see the places where they were copying scrolls that they would then take home to their Essene communities. Because you're not going to do it in the temple, because it's been fouled up. Okay, it's not true. Okay, so yeah, so the Essenes are the Dead Sea Scroll people. The Zealots just want the Romans gone, and they have these knives, these little daggers that they've got called the Sicarii, and these are the daggermen. The Sicarii will hide the dagger in their robe. And then I'm going to mix at Passover with all the crowds and everything. And here comes a Roman soldier. Well, I'm mixing here, and I can just go stab, put my dagger back in. Oh, the Romans got killed. Somebody stabbed a Roman. Bad. Okay. The Zealots, just before the temple was finally destroyed in 70 AD, these guys burned all the foodstuffs. They burned all the food. You know? So anyway, these guys we know, and Jesus is going to interact with. Okay. All right, I'm going to skip this one. There's because ahead of this, I wanted to figure out how we're going to do this. So
can you go back to that?
This one?
Yeah. Thank you.
I'm talking about the house of Hillel and the house of Shammai. Yeah. You know, we'll get into that when we talk about Paul. Okay. So. Here's our other problem, trying to understand the scriptures in context. Okay? The problem is translation from any one language to another is always hard, isn't it? And so we low about these things because of translations from one language to another. Okay? So I just want to give you one example of translating from Hebrew, especially the Masoretic text that we have, that contained all the Hebrew, and we're trying to get those to understand the Old Testament and all that. Okay, look at this. So if you saw this word in Hebrew, you'd probably really agree with that. You just go, yay, it's true. Okay, we like that. Okay? Except you don't read Hebrew. And I know about that much. Okay? So let me make it a little bit easier. Let me transliterate that from Hebrew to that, going in their direction from right to left. So now this translates into English just like that. Because the problem is, in most Jewish writing, especially the ancient writing, what do they leave out? The vowels. These are all vowels, except the yod. These are all consonants, and you leave the vowels out. Okay? Now, if you're leaving out the vowels, then this is what you're stuck with. Okay? How are we doing so far? You ready to cheer for that?
Your characters don't correspond.
No, they don't, because sometimes
I mean, your two L's don't look the same up above, and your S's don't look the same
up above. It's true. Yeah, because if it's at the end of a word, it's different than if it's in the middle of a word, and... Okay, so let me help you further. I'm going to turn it around, and we'll do it from left to right. Does that help?
No.
Okay. All right, so now, if you're going to read things in context, if you get one word, you might be able to guess the rest of them. Okay? So let's see how you do. So I'll give you a hint. This is, that's actually a guttural sound. So this would be Elohim. Okay, because him is a plural ending, and of course God would be plural, right? So Joseph Smith knows. Elohim.
Bless Texas.
There you go. Nice. Okay, so here's Elohim, and then we get, so then you're going to say, this is probably God bless
Texas.
And it, so, but we're still not sure. So if we had a comma and the next word said something about Davy Crockett or Alamo, you might, this is God bless Texas. But what if the very next word talked about the IRS? Then what's that? Might that be?
It's just like bless your heart.
Taxes.
It'd be blunt. It'd be what?
Taxes.
So God bless taxes. Oh, okay. But and we only know that because we're able to see it in context. And maybe find every other place in the scriptures where this shows up. And you go, oh, it was actually, we thought it was Texas. It's actually taxes. What if, though, the next line talked about wedding clothiers?
Texas.
It might be God bless Texas. Right?
These are all sound translations. But, I mean, Hebrew and English don't sound similar.
Well, they can. Yeah, I mean, if you're translating into English, you'll transliterate it. And I'm just doing this in literal.
Sure.
Because we don't know what the Hebrew word for Texas or Elohim we know. Bless, I can't remember what that is. But just to give you an idea, so this could be Texas, it could be taxes, it could be Texas. And so that's why you have to know you try and find everywhere in the Old Testament that maybe that those same combination of letters comes together, and what does it generally mean? Okay? So, context is how the word is translated. Okay? So, in the time that we've got remaining, I want to show you a couple of things here. Because what I'm going to tell you is the translation as we look at the New Testament and context becomes really important. Okay? In fact, let me jump to this. Let me do this. Okay? Now, so that's one of the reasons why when we're looking at the New Testament, we're going to look at a variety of translations that give us help. Okay, this is one of my favorites because there's going to be a variety of translations out there. When the King James translation came into being, King James translators were looking at Tyndale's translation, but they also had about 5,000 Greek documents that they were drawing from. Okay, this is Thomas Wayman's BYU New Testament translation. He had at his disposal 20,000 Greek documents. Okay, and one of the things that Thomas tried to do was make this available so that the Bible becomes more readable. Okay, so let me give you an example. Somebody feeling in a good reading mood. I think I've demonstrated this before. Who wants to read?
I'll read.
Okay, fire it, Jim. Okay, so this is going to be the King James Version of Romans 7. From the King James Version.
For we know that the law is spiritual, but I am carnal, sold under sin. For that which I do, I allow not. For what I would, that I do not. But what I hate, that I do. For the good that I would do not, for the good that I would, I do not, but the evil which I would not, that I do.
So if you're going to sit down and read your scriptures for the day, and it's like, well, now I'm edified, Wow, that is really, really good.
Right. And so you just have to read it slow and digest it every thought at a time, though.
All right.
Now translate that to English.
Okay, so Brent, now I'm going to have you read, and this comes from this, okay?
Okay.
So here's the BYU Waymon.
For we know that the law is spiritual, but I am mortal, sold as a slave to sin. For I do not understand my own actions, for I do not do what I want to do, but I do the thing I hate to do. For I can desire to do what is right, but I am not able to do it.
Does that help? Yeah.
Or we could just say, I know better than I do.
Yeah. Well, yeah, his next line to be, and so I struggle with this. Now, anybody identify with this? I don't want to eat that cookie, but I did it anyway.
No, I wanted to eat the cookie, and I did it anyway.
And I did it anyway, so
I knew I shouldn't.
Yes. Now, see, if you're going to spend a few minutes in the scriptures, and like I said, this is right out of Romans 7, this is why Romans and writings of Paul are so impossible for us to understand, because this is King James translation based on what they have. So I'm just going to make a suggestion that one of the things, we're going to use the King James Version some because it's poetic and we love the King James Version and it's what we're familiar with. But when we're trying to understand, we're going to look at several different versions. In fact, if you listen to Elder Uchtdorf when he talks, and then you look at the footnotes on his talks, do you know what version he's using?
German.
No? You would think he would, but that's not what's showing up.
New International, I think.
He's using the NRSV.
Yeah.
Use the NRSV. Now, sometimes they use the ESV, but a lot of times that's the version that I like the most, is the NRSV, and well, it is. It's just a different translation, but sometimes you look at different translations so that you understand. Okay? All right.
Now, Wayman, what is the source of his words? I mean, where did he come from? Original documentation, or was it a transliteration of another script?
No, what happens is every year there's an international Greek society that, because Wayman is actually he'll tell you he's a papyri, how's he say it? He studies ancient papyri, so he reads Greek and he reads all the ancient papyri, and he'll go all over the world looking at these documents. But every time they discover a new Greek piece of papyrus, they'll add it to this collection in there. So good translations are then saying, let's look at all the thing that's now available to us. Because the very earliest New Testament stuff that we have actually is that sounded really weird. It's Codex Sinaiticus. It's actually one that they found at Sinai. And it's 250 A.D. So what we got is copies of copies of copies of copies. And so the Old Testament, we had the Septuagint that was written in 400, but we have some. But even those are copies.
So he's looking at how many copies say the same thing.
That's right.
But he's also looking at how much older are the ones than the other ones.
And putting extra weight on the oldest ones.
The older it is, the better, and the more there are, the better.
Yeah.
So then when we say this one went back to the original documents, what are the original?
The original that we have are like 200 A.D.
That's the ones you're talking about.
Yeah, it's like we're going back as far as we can.
We're not going back to...
Because we don't have anything
original.
We're not
going back to handwritten and Martin.
No, they're looking... Well, sometimes they're handwritten things. They're just finding these, like... The stuff from the Dead Sea Scrolls, like the Isaiah Scrolls, they were able to find some things there.
But they just can't figure out which one is the original one.
But if they have five documents that say it this way with this letter, and one document that has that letter, they'll usually go with that one. I mean, it's just, there's this process. All I'm saying is it's the most accurate stuff we have.
I was going to say, there are no real
originals. No originals of any of this.
Kevin, this Wayman is a professor at BYU.
Mm-hmm.
How long did it, I assume he had some
years.
Staff.
No.
He did it by himself.
He did it by himself. Yeah, we had him here about 5 years ago, right as this came out, and spoke, and I had a chance to visit with him, and I've actually heard him a couple of other places as well. Right now he's working on the Old Testament. And he says this may take him the rest of his career.
How long did it take him to do this?
Years. Because not only is he looking at the documents, he's also looking at what's available out there. And then what he's doing, one of the things I like about this book.
Does it have the Joseph Smith?
Yes. He's included down in here Joseph Smith additions to this. He'll say sometimes most of the documents are saying this. There is a couple that say this. So he's trying to be as transparent as he can. But then he's going to put it in language. Because the other thing that he wanted us to know, and he's very emphatic about this, is just a reminder that when Jesus was standing giving the Sermon on the Mount, he didn't speak 12th century King James English. Surprise, surprise. There weren't these and thous.
So we don't know if it's taxes or Texas.
We don't. That's true.
He was doing it.
Yeah.
An anecdote, 3M Corporation had this very successful advertising campaign for Scotch tape.
Uh-huh.
And you might remember it, Scotch tape sticks like crazy.
Yeah.
And so they expanded the advertising campaign and went multinational with it. And in Japan and many Asian countries, it destroyed their market share because it translated to Scotch tape sticks foolishly. And if you're foolish, you just lose. Nobody has any respect for you.
Yeah. Okay.
So it ruined
Chevy. Chevy in Mexico is no go.
Yeah. Is Mr. Wayman's name on the Bible?
Yeah, and if you just go on to Amazon, you can find Wayman.
Amazon,
he deserves to have his name on the
Bible. There's an earlier one in green, and this is actually an expanded one, the one in blue. I've got both of them. Okay, I'm just going to...
$28 on Amazon.
How does he support himself?
He's a BYU professor.
But is he teaching classes and doing all
yeah,
this work
too? Yeah, he's a professor of English.
Do you think there's ever a time that the church would change the version of the Bible? There's nothing sacred about the King James.
No.
I mean, it's
well, it was the J. Reuben Clark.
It's the best that he had at the time.
Okay, so let me just... By the way, this is... I'll show you this, I'll read this, and then we'll be done. This is the other place that I go, is that if I'm trying to understand a word, the Blue Letter Bible, and I'll show you this real quick. If I go to Genesis 1:1, verse at a time, what it does is it takes every, I don't know if you can see that very well. It takes every verse, and then it breaks it down. If I hit tools, and I look at the interlinear, what it's going to do is take every single word. And so this, in this case, it's going to say, in the beginning. And you go, okay, what is beginning? Well, the word is receipt. And actually, I should have.
Strong's H, 7225. Reshith.
Okay.
Second entry. Reshith.
Thank you. All right. So I get the pronunciation, and then he's going to break it down. You're going to break it down and say, in the beginning, you're going to get all this information. And it's going to say, well, how do we know? Well, when we look in the Old Testament, it's translated as beginning 18 times, first fruits 11 times, first is 6 times. In other words, where in context is it used the most? Okay? And then, because I use this a lot, and then it's going to show you every time in the scriptures where that word receipt shows up, so you can then compare it. More than you really want to know, right? Okay. All right. But anyway, I like the Blue Letter Bible. And if I have a question about a word, I'm constantly going here to try and tear things apart. Okay? All right. Let me finish with this. When Wayman wrote this, part of what he said was is that he had it. He wanted to make sure that he wasn't doing anything contrary to what the church was wanting done. So he actually just before he finished the translation, he sent copies of it. Well, he said, I sent copies to the people in the red chairs. And the people in the red chairs gave some to the people in the blue chairs. And the people in the blue chairs, he said, I found a quote, I had a quote from Brigham Young, and I had it included in the volume. And the word from the people in the blue chairs was that when you print this, we want you to include the quote in the first part of the book, in the introduction. So here's the quote from the first part here, from Brigham Young. If the Bible be translated incorrectly, and if there is a scholar on earth who professes to be a Christian, and he can translate it any better than the King James translators did it, he is under obligation to do so, or the curse is upon him. If I understood Greek and Hebrew, as some may profess to do, and I knew the Bible was not correctly translated, I should feel myself bound by the law of justice to the inhabitants of the earth to translate that which is incorrect and give it as it was spoken anciently. Is that proper? Yes, I would be under obligation.
Wow.
It's pretty good. So that's what he felt like, and they felt like, we're not replacing the King James Version, but we need to have a way that this can be written much and read much more plainly.
This would be really hard to do without computers.
Oh, incredibly hard, yeah.
How did it come out with the men in the red chairs?
They loved it.
They did.
They love it. There were some senior BYU faculty that were a little threatened by the fact that there was a new one come out.
But that book is actually, I mean, it's hard to read that book the same way you would read the Bible.
Yeah, because right. So, but again, when we start studying New Testament, I show up with this in Gospel Doctrine. They ask me to read, and I go, okay, you ready for this? And I'll read that part. Wow, that sounds really great. Okay, so comments on any of this? I just think, because part of what I'm hoping we do with the New Testament in this next year is that we dig in, that we read it critically, that we try and understand what's there, because there's real beauty in understanding the context, the language, the religion, and I think it gives us, and again, then you guys are going to be nasty,
Pharisees,
ready for the following January. You're just going to know all kinds of stuff. Yeah.
Here's my problem. I'm dyslexic. So when I'm reading stuff, it's really hard for me to understand. And so reading the Bible, the way that it's written, like what you just showed up here, it's hard for me to understand what it is that I'm reading. So if I'm wanting to read the Bible, should I read this instead, that it's more plain, that I can...
I think you ought to at least try it. In fact, I've got it. I tell you what, I've got this on... I've got it on Kindle, and so I can look at it on Kindle, and it was cheap. It wasn't even that much.
$10. Looks like a print where you can get the print a little bit bigger too than what's on there.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, that's what. And so one of the things that I do when I'm teaching a class like this using New Testament, I will go to the Kindle version of this, expand the sieve, and then I cut and paste from that and put it on my PowerPoint. So, and that may help with that. Now you can also, if you get it on something like that, it'll be easier for you to read. I do. So. All right. Is that plenty?
You can get a Kindle app for your computer, can't you?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. No, you get it for your phone. You can get Kindle app for your phone or your computer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I look at my...
Do I have to pay for the Kindle app?
No.
Uh-uh.
No, and any books that you buy... You put it on Kindle, it will be on the Kindle app on your phone and on the Kindle app on your computer. You can access it.
See, this is the first one that he...
And you can cut and paste from a Kindle.
Yes. Yeah, I've done it before.
Okay.
I have.
All right. So anyway, it's up there. Anyway, so I'm looking forward to doing the New Testament. I just think it gives us a chance to dig in and find some things that maybe we might have missed in the past. And hopefully we'll learn something. And I leave that with you in Jesus' name. All right. And thank you for joining us for another Monday morning class. Hope you enjoyed it. If you have any suggestions about future topics that we could discuss, or if you had any questions concerning something that you heard in the class, please drop us a note. We'd love to hear from you. As always, if you happen to be in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, please come in and join us on a Monday morning. We'd love to see you and identify who you are. If the podcast itself is resonating with you, go ahead and click subscribe so that Apple can figure out where we are. We'd love to hear from you. So again, thank you for coming, and we'll see you for another Monday morning class.